Lecture 16, Launching World War II.
The night in Manchuria was quiet, except for a small and expert team of Japanese soldiers who were on the move, on a special mission. They moved stealthily up to the railroad line, a few miles north of the Chinese city of Mukden. Working efficiently, they entrenched 42 yellow packages of explosives snugly around the rails. This was the South Manchurian Railway in China's Kwantung region. The Kwantung region was in the northeast corner of China, known as Manchuria, across from northern Korea. This region had long been the plaything of outside powers. Under pressure in the age of imperialism, China had leased Kwantung to Russia. But after the Russo-Japanese War, the lease had been transferred to victorious Japan. A Japanese army was stationed there, and in the 1930s would use this as a base to carve a Japanese empire out of the living body of China. Japanese nationalists called this splitting up the Chinese melon. But a pretext was needed to begin a larger attack, and this would be that incident. Shortly after 10:30 on September 18, 1931, the explosives were detonated. The results of the explosion were not huge, a gap of 31 inches blown in the rails. But the pretext would do. The Japanese army announced that it was shocked that it had been attacked by the Chinese, and now Japan would have to respond to this terrorist outrage in self-defense. Immediately, pre-positioned Japanese forces went into action. Cities and towns in Manchuria along the railway were occupied. Heavy artillery, which the Japanese had smuggled into Mukden in advance and had hidden in a construction site, now opened fire on the Chinese army barracks. Japanese reinforcements were rushed in, and in an amazing display of preparedness, some of these troops actually were mobilized even before the orders reached them. China was too weak to launch an all-out war to resist, so China appealed to the League of Nations and to world opinion. When foreign journalists were allowed to visit 5 days later, the Japanese military showed them the bodies of several dead Chinese soldiers at the scene of the explosion. How this deception, the product of a covert operation, led to the outbreak of World War II in Asia and provided an inspiration for other later deceptions, we trace later in this lecture. The key point for now is that scenes like this would become common in the lead-up to World War II, which broke out earlier in Asia than it did in Europe, a fact that's sometimes forgotten. As the world lurched towards another world war, espionage activity escalated, with Japanese spies in Manchuria and Hawaii, fascist and communist spies in the Spanish Civil War, and in other hotspots. One imperative for intelligence agencies in Europe was to take the measure of the new Nazi regime that had come to power in 1933. Here, we need to engage in an act of historical imagination, to imagine our way back and try to put to one side what we now know about the course of international politics and Hitler's unleashing of a new world war. We need to try to somehow regain the sense of uncertainty that contemporaries at the time had about what would happen next. The Nazis were clearly militaristic. Their strutting, marching, and uniforms prove that. Their leader, Hitler, constantly rehearsed the wrongs of the Versailles Treaty that had ended the First World War, and Hitler demanded again and again that Germany receive its due in world politics. But at the same time, Hitler was also masking his aggressive intentions in peace campaigns, insisting that, of course, he was a veteran of the trenches, and he knew the reality of war, and that if only Germany were given equal treatment, war could be avoided. So how could one know what Hitler would do next? British intelligence wrestled with this problem and used both clandestine sources as well as public information from the media in Germany to form a picture of German intentions and capacities. And what they saw was troubling. Germany was rearming, secretly, to the extent that something so big as national rearmament could really be kept secret. And in defiance of the severe restrictions on German armaments that had been set down in the Versailles Treaty after World War I. Military production in Germany was veiled and disguised, and this occasioned a joke that circulated in Nazi Germany that I can't resist telling. It's about a factory worker in a German production plant devoted to building baby carriages. This factory worker learns to his delight that his wife is going to have their first child soon. So he devises a plan. Every day he'll smuggle a different part out of the factory, taking it off the assembly line, and eventually at home, when he has all the parts, he'll be able himself to put together a free baby carriage. Months pass, and the baby's almost due, but there's no baby carriage. And friends see the factory worker is glum and depressed, so they ask him, "What's wrong? What's happened to your plan for the baby carriage?" The worker answers that he's tried the plan 3 times now, but every time when he finishes putting together all the stolen parts, the baby carriage turns out to be a machine gun. It was a joke, but with truth behind it. By 1935, German rearmament was no secret. Hitler announced it publicly, including the expansion of Germany's army through the draft, the building of a massive new air force, the Luftwaffe, as well. Both were measures forbidden by the Versailles Treaty, but that was a dead letter by now. British intelligence was especially worried about the new German air force. The British would have to not only estimate its size now using their intelligence resources, but predict its growth in the future. No easy task. Cooperating with the French intelligence services, the British experts sweated over this problem. At first, they significantly underestimated the size of German air production, then swung to an alarming revision which suggested a future German knockout blow directed against Britain. No one really knew at this time what full-scale air war, and especially strategic bombing, could do. The First World War had already seen the beginnings of this kind of warfare, and what it would mean for the future worried experts, who feared that the civilian population in cities that were bombed would panic and collapse under its impact. In addition, the maxim became popular at the time that, quote, "the bomber always gets through," unquote, because few at the time could imagine what an effective defense against death from the air could be like. The reality, thankfully, turned out to be different in practice. To experts, London looked so vulnerable, so indefensible, and the casualties in wartime likely to be so appalling from bombing that the Air Force intelligence worked with worst-case scenarios. They estimated that German bombing of Britain would produce daily casualties on the ground of about 50,000. When British and French leaders sought to appease Hitler, it was in part out of this prospect, which was driving them to desperation, up to and including the Munich Conference of 1938, in which Czechoslovakia's fate was turned over to Hitler. Happily for Britain, these estimates, in error though they were, also drove British rearmament, especially the Air Force, which helped when war at last broke out. At the same time, for another country, taking the measure of the Nazis was especially urgent, and that was Poland, because it was a neighbor of Hitler's and likely to be a target. Polish cryptographers helped to break the German military code, Enigma, which would be of tremendous value to the Western Allies when World War II came. Enigma was actually an encryption machine, invented and patented by a German engineer during the 1920s. The German army and navy had adopted the machine soon after, so this was happening well before the Nazis had come to power. What was so appealing about the Enigma machine was that its inner workings promised to produce an almost unbreakable encryption for messages. The machine was quite small, about the size of a typewriter. Special rotors were inserted into the top of the machine, and the controls would be used to adjust the circuitry inside the machine, so that a message that went through would be both mechanically and electronically encrypted. And, just to make it even better, every time the operator pressed another key, all of the settings would all move and change for the next letter. Only the receiver on the other end, sitting at another Enigma machine, who had advanced knowledge of the initial settings, could work the process in reverse and decode the entire message. This kind of encryption resulted in 400 quadrillion possible combinations, and thus an earlier vulnerability of codes seemed to have been overcome. In earlier code breaking, the frequent use of particular letters, each language has its own letters that occur most often. In English, for instance, it's E and T. So the frequent use of particular letters would mean that talented guesswork or inspired guesses could be applied in matching those letters to particular symbols or numbers in a code that recur most often. Enigma seemed to foreclose that. Note that I said seemed, because it would be the overweening confidence of the Germans in the unbreakability of their Enigma machine that would allow them to keep using it in spite of suggestions, perhaps, hints, perhaps, that the Allies had broken that code. But for Poland, neighboring on Germany, being able to follow German actions, plans, and intentions before the war broke out seemed of existential importance. From 1928, Polish mathematics students were being trained in cryptography for the cause of national defense and then were set loose on the problem of trying to break the Enigma code. It was at this point that cooperation between different national intelligence services proved to be key. The French cryptological department in late 1932, which knew that the Poles were working on the Enigma question, passed to Poland some information that they had gotten from a German code clerk who had passed along key data. This data included operators' manuals for the Enigma machine and, crucially, a list of the correct settings for several past months' use of the German Enigma machine. The Polish experts now were able to go back to previously intercepted communications from the Germans, and by an amazing feat of reverse engineering, were able to work out, by decrypting those earlier intercepts, how the German Enigma machines were built. And they were able to build functioning replicas or copies of the German Enigma machine. And so, by this talented labor, for the next 7 years, the Poles were able to decrypt German military communication. Not all of it, but up to 75% of messages by 1938, which could be tremendously helpful. It was at that point, in 1938, that a change in the German procedure cut them off again, because the machine had been tinkered with and improved. But in a very important, one might say fateful act, the Poles gave all that they knew, along with copies of their Enigma copies of the original machines, to the French and the British, only a few weeks before the Nazis invaded Poland, so that their work was now passed to Allied intelligence agencies. Half the world away, another storm had been gathering in the 1930s over Asia. This involved the continuing ambitions of Japan, which had made, as we've already noted in earlier lectures, the remarkable and self-willed transition to not be one of the victims of European imperialism, but instead to become an imperialist power itself and a player in the great game of imperialism. Over the last decades, before and after the Russo-Japanese War, secret Japanese nationalist societies had agitated and had put pressure on the Japanese government for and had planned for the carving out of a Japanese-controlled empire in East Asia. And most of all, they looked across the water at Manchuria and the rest of China. Among these nationalist societies was the Black Dragon Society, founded in 1901, which was excited about the prospects of expansion into Manchuria and Siberia. Japan had launched its imperialist expansion by going to war with China back in 1894, and then, you'll remember, had struck Russia in 1904 and had won a tremendous victory in the Russo-Japanese War. After this victory, Japan annexed Korea in 1910 as a building block in its future Asian empire. In the 1931 Manchurian crisis, the Japanese military staged the Mukden incident, blowing up a railway. This is the story with which we began this particular lecture. They claimed that it was a Chinese terrorist attack. Japanese military forces took over the entire province, which was an area larger than the state of Texas, and established there, under their control, the puppet state of Manchukuo. The Mukden incident itself, and the Japanese claims that it was a Chinese outrage, really weren't believed by many people. It was so scandalous at the time that it even makes an appearance in some children's literature, in the Tintin comic strip drawn and written by the Belgian cartoonist Hergé. The episode is The Blue Lotus, which was published in 1934 and is still in print today and is testimony to the impact of the Mukden incident internationally. By the way, it's sure to have occurred to you to ask the question, how do we know that the Mukden incident was staged by the Japanese army? How do we know the true story behind the incident? And this is an example of something that I mentioned right at the start of our course. It's an example of how it can often take a tremendous amount of time before the full facts emerge, if they ever do, about covert operations and about the secret history of the secret world. What happened in this case was this. After World War II, an international trial was held by the victorious Allied powers in Tokyo from 1946 to 1948 to hold people accountable for Japanese war crimes. It was like the better-known Nuremberg trial in Germany. Testimony taken in these trials, which alleged a long-range conspiracy dating back to the Mukden incident, revealed that the Japanese army had staged that outrage. After the League of Nations criticized the occupation of Manchuria, Japan simply left the League in 1933, and Japanese attacks on China continued. In 1937, fighting broke out between the Chinese and the Japanese troops in Beijing, leading to 8 years of horrific war and Japanese control of northern China and the coasts. Japanese intelligence now prepared for further campaigns and further undertakings in another direction, not towards China, but westwards into the great expanses of the Pacific Ocean. The Versailles Treaty that ended the First World War in 1919 had taken away German colonies and had given them around the world to different victorious powers as so-called mandates, territories that were to be administered for now, but eventually at some unspecified date were to pass to self-rule. Japan in the Pacific had been assigned German possessions, including the Marshalls, the Carolines, and the Mariana Islands. The Japanese now planned to build up these islands with airfields and military fortifications to establish a formidable position in the Pacific region strategically. Even though the United States and Japan had been on the same side in World War I, an abiding distrust of Japanese intentions was held by many in the American political leadership at this time. American agents were sent to investigate, and some never returned alive. There has been persistent speculation that Amelia Earhart was one of them. Amelia Earhart was a remarkable woman flyer from Kansas who had flown across the Atlantic by herself in 1932. In 1937, she set off for a flight around the world. The flight path that she and her navigator were to take came close to the Japanese mandates in the Pacific. On that flight, they both disappeared. And in spite of an extensive search, no definitive proof of their fate was found at the time, nor even to this very day. In 2011, DNA tests were done on some bones that had been found on an isolated Pacific island, but those results were declared inconclusive. Had Earhart been on a mission, as some claimed afterwards? We may never know. Some historical mysteries are never solved. Some mysteries simply abide. The United States also faced another problem. It lacked agents in Japan. In other words, it didn't have HUMINT for its intelligence gathering. Thus, it became imperative to work through SIGINT, signals intelligence, to discern Japanese intentions by means of cracking their codes. You'll recall from Lecture 13 that in 1929, the United States Secretary of State Stimson had shut down the cryptological services of the State Department with that ringing and noble declaration that gentlemen do not read each other's mail. But the United States Army work on cryptology did continue on a small scale. The Signal Intelligence Service was established in April of 1930. This work was led by William F. Friedman, a tremendously talented analyst who worked with four subordinates and one clerk in their small office. Friedman was the son of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. As a young man, he had been hired by an eccentric millionaire in the United States to prove the rich man's theory that Sir Francis Bacon's writings contained coded messages. You can see where this is probably going, that prove that Bacon was the real author of Shakespeare's plays. This is a part of a persistent search to uncover who really wrote Shakespeare. While nothing came of this project, Friedman found himself intrigued by decoding, and he turned ever more away from his earlier scientific work on genetics towards cryptology. During the First World War, he had worked under Herbert Yardley, who was the man who ran the Black Chamber in the State Department, who was the object of Stimson's declaration about not reading mail. A master at cryptology, Friedman was just the right man for the new task of running the Signal Intelligence Service, and he in fact coined the term cryptanalysis to describe their work. The staff was, you might call them, a merry bunch of cipher nerds who did things like sending each other Christmas cards in code. Their greatest challenge was an innovation which the Japanese introduced in 1939, in part because of their reading of Yardley's best-selling book about the American Black Chamber, which had revealed the earlier breaking of Japanese codes. The new Japanese innovation was a cipher machine called the 97 Shiki Obun Injiki, or the alphabetical typewriter 97, which was based on the German Enigma machine, but improved on it by a double encryption and by the use of multiple electrical switches with a plug board, making it even harder to break than the Enigma. From February 1939, Friedman ordered his staff to drop everything else and just work on the challenge of the Japanese code. One break came because of the formality of diplomatic language, which allowed code breakers to look for repeated formulas of greeting or salutations at the start and at the end of communications. The other breakthrough involved mathematical analysis of the language patterns in all the intercepts, an amazing feat of number crunching, or in this case, language crunching. Using this information, the Americans were able to build a replica of the Japanese machine. The Americans referred to their replica and to the Japanese original machine as purple. Friedman fondly called his small, talented staff magicians, and thus the decrypts of purple were called magic. The strain of all of those days of nonstop work meant that after the breaking of the code was done, Friedman collapsed and had to be hospitalized for some months, but his triumph was significant. If the decrypts could be correctly understood and used, they could shape sensible policy in the U.S. At the same time, Japan was also ramping up its spying efforts in the United States. Most intelligence gathering was done by the staff of Japanese embassies and consulates. A special target for observation and espionage was the American naval base at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. The very fact that the base and installations were visible from surrounding heights around it made observation easier than it might have been otherwise. The Japanese consulate in Honolulu was a good base. Its treasurer made a good observer. He got a copy of Jane's Fighting Ships, a guidebook on naval hardware, ordered a taxi, and acting like a tourist, simply enjoyed beautiful views that included the warships at the base. Another agent was then sent to join the consulate as well. His real name was Takeo Yoshikawa, a 28-year-old naval officer. His cover was excellent. Even his other colleagues at the consulate considered him with distaste as a lazy, good-for-nothing partier. In fact, Yoshikawa spied from cabs as well, tried to learn what he could about when the fleet would be in harbor and when ships were anchored, and he brilliantly exploited another opportunity when the Wheeler Air Base had an open house. He simply strolled about with everyone else, observing all that he could. Later, as his superiors demanded more and more specific information about the island's defenses, Yoshikawa again posed as a tourist and took a tourist flight over the island. For such an able agent, however, he had one worry. He was troubled at having to work with another spy for the Japanese. This was a resident German, Dr. Bernard Kuhn, a former German Navy officer in World War I, now a fanatical Nazi, and a terrible spy. American intelligence had suspected Kuhn from the moment he got to Hawaii. He was instructed to be a sleeper agent and not to engage in any espionage until war broke out, as then he would replace Yoshikawa, who would be expelled. Kuhn did not follow these instructions and felt an inner calling to be hanging out at the Navy Yard to observe. Even this spying, however, of Kuhn's was a waste of time because it turns out that, unable to actually get accurate counts, he would just make up numbers of ships for his report anyhow. On a quiet Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941, a date that will live in infamy, the Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor began, launched by an armada that had crept across the Pacific, observing radio silence. As the attack raged, the Japanese consulate burned documents. Dr. Kuhn, who remember was supposed to lie low as a sleeper agent, now felt called upon to send messages from his roof while the attack was on. What was he thinking? He was immediately spotted by the FBI and arrested. The attack on Pearl Harbor represented an American intelligence failure. And from then on, over the following decades to the present day, the American intelligence services would describe often their task as preventing another Pearl Harbor, preventing another bolt out of the blue. How had this failure happened? The United States had cracked the Japanese codes, and the so-called Operation Magic was producing high-level intelligence. But these documents were highly restricted and often without other supplementary information. They could seem incomplete to analysts who wouldn't understand their full import. In particular, what information there was had not been passed to the command at Pearl Harbor. Because the Japanese military had been very good about keeping operational details secret, even from Japanese diplomats, there was no one message, for instance, in the diplomatic code from Japan that would have announced an attack on Pearl Harbor. So I want to be clear here, I'm not impugning the American commanders. There was no one person responsible for this malfunction. Rather, the problem lay with a piecing together of circumstantial evidence in just the right way. And behind this lay other difficulties that we'd mentioned already, the difficulty in getting HUMINT from Japan, which might have verified the SIGINT or signals intelligence that was coming through. Fortunately, however, as we'll see in our next lecture, MAGIC provided crucial information during the war that ensued. Back in Europe, in 1936, a war broke out that has been called a dress rehearsal for World War II. This was the Spanish Civil War. Spanish nationalist forces under General Francisco Franco staged a military revolt against the Spanish Republic. The Popular Front of Democrats, Socialists, Anarchists, and Communists supported the Republic. The war that followed was brutal and devastating. It was filled with atrocities, costing about 500,000 lives as it drew in outside powers to fight in Spain. Nazi Germany and fascist Italy sent, watch for the quotation marks, volunteers to help Franco, including German dive bombers, while brigades of international volunteers from Britain, France, the United States, and elsewhere who wanted to strike back at fascism also trekked to Spain to aid the Republic. Stalin sent advisors and supplies, but on his orders, the Spanish communist forces also set about purging their own anarchist allies in the Popular Front, thus undermining the Republican war effort, and Franco was finally the winner in 1939. At this time, Kim Philby, whom we met in the previous lecture, the Cambridge graduate newly recruited by Soviet intelligence, got some of his first taste of espionage. He was using the cover of a journalist to be active behind the lines of Franco's forces in Spain. And at one point, he was interrogated by Franco's police and was in a dangerous situation when they started to go through his pockets because he remembered that hidden there was a piece of rice paper with instructions on how to encode communications to his Soviet superiors. They picked him up in his hotel room, and the police marched him back to the police station, walking behind him, so he was never able to dispose of the message on the way. What would you have done? While he was being searched, Philby accidentally threw his wallet, which went flying across the table, skittering along. As his interrogators scrambled for it and turned away from him for a moment, he was able to swallow the paper. Seemingly innocent, he was released. The Spanish Civil War also gave us a linguistic legacy that speaks to espionage and sabotage. It's an expression still used today of a fifth column, to describe an organized internal conspiracy that cooperates with the enemy of a country. Its origin was this. In 1936, one of Franco's generals gave a threatening broadcast as he advanced on the capital of Madrid to shake the confidence of the city's defenders. He announced that his army had four columns marching on Madrid, and inside Madrid was a fifth column of saboteurs. This was a new expression for an old theme, that of the Trojan horse, which we discussed all the way back at the start of this course. Ultimately, the dark decade of the 1930s was also a great gift to storytellers about spying and writers of thrillers, and we'll discuss in Lecture 21 the great novelists who crafted stories set in this period and after. In closing, let us note that World War II in Europe also began with a covert operation of deception that bore an uncanny resemblance to the Mukden incident with which we began. In typical Nazi fashion, Hitler started the war with a lie. This was the claim that the Poles had attacked a German radio station on the border and they started World War II. The first victim of the war, in fact, was a Polish farmer. In their plans, the Polish farmer was referred to as canned meat, human material, in other words. After he had been ambushed in his home, he was drugged, driven to the radio station by SS men, dressed in a Polish uniform, and then shot to leave evidence, along with the bodies of several convicts. The next morning, Hitler announced to the world that the German army had been fired on and was firing back. World War II had begun with a lie, and we'll examine that titanic conflict in our next lecture.